Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, you're very welcome along to this week's episode of the Group Chat Podcast. I have no idea why we're laughing, but Gavin has lost the plot. It's okay, sorry. We're going to keep going. No, we're going to keep going.
Keep rolling, I'll just be 30 seconds. Just
okay, going. There's nothing in the brownies, by the way.
Like,
there was a scurrilous accusation made about my brownies there.
Sorry.
Zara's here, Richard's here.
Hello.
No, I'm sorry, this is genuinely unprofessional, so we're going
Gavin is losing his mind.
You made brownies anyway, Zara.
I made brownies, everyone.
They're great.
Do you want to have it?
I've already had a little bit.
The brownies are genuinely lovely.
Thank you.
The one thing I... What this brings back to me.
Why are they zooming in on me eating the brownies?
I know, don't zoom in on the eating of the
brownies. When you were, when we were all working together first in News Talk, you used to routinely bring brownies back after a weekend in Waterford, and they were always delightful.
Yeah, Evoke.ie did write a really unflattering article about me one time about the fact that my mother used to bake goods so I could make friends in the office, which was partially true for sure. But
still stings a bit though.
It hurt a little bit. Yeah.
It worked though, because we're still here 10 years
later. They
called
my mom the wrong name. Her name is Maria, not Bernie. But anyway, how endeavour. I did bake some brownies. I just took a notion on Sunday that I would get back into baking again, because you remember I was baking during
You were great actually. Yeah, banana bread in particular was good. Yeah,
I do like it because I do feel like it gets you off your phone, and it's kind of one of these like distractions that sort of isn't focused on
like that.
Being on screens. Yeah. So yeah, I'm sure it won't last. It's been 3 days, so you know me and my phase.
Well, we're the beneficiaries of this, you know, the notion that you've taken.
Yes.
And as long as it you know persists,
I think it's got a good texture in the middle now.
Yeah, no, it's good. Yeah, it's like a right amount of gooiness in that brownie. Mm.
Thank you.
Plus the chips inside, the white chocolate chips.
It's
just good.
It's not dry, but nor does it have the dreaded soggy bottom.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, Gavin. Thank you. Okay, we're going to jump right into a story that has been going on for 8 months now. And I do admit that sometimes I ask myself, are our listeners sick of hearing about this? Are we sick of talking about it? Or is it still just really important that we continue to have the discussion about RTE? And it does come in the week when the Public Accounts Committee has published its final report, and Shuni Raleigh, shots fired, has come out and said that Catherine Martin had a hands-off approach to the situation.
The shots fired thing is why this is salient, because I fully sympathise with people who are now sick to the back teeth of the media and us and others going on about it all the time. Mm. The reason why it is kind of necessary to keep going on about it is because we keep talking about different things. And I appreciate that people who were paying attention last June and who think, oh, is the Ryan Tuberty undisclosed payments thing, is that not put to bed now? Why is it still going on? Like, why are we still dragging this on? But yeah, it was put to bed, and then other things came up, like the barter accounts and the flip-flops. And now it's coming up to, you know, whether the government knew exactly what was going on in RTE. And now it's, did the minister in fact fire someone on TV who she said out loud she was trying to salvage in the job? Which is a pretty significant thing. So that's why Shuni Raleigh had her 2,300 word tea spilling exercise on Monday afternoon, really pointing out that she felt like she was basically shoved under a bus, that there was a plot afoot to ultimately traduce her reputation. And she's basically saying the minister kind of sacked her for really no understandable or no viable reason, which is a fair thing for the media to feel like it has to cover.
Traduce was really like select, wasn't it? I mean, like, to use the word traduce, like, it had to have been
good word.
Really well thought out.
It's a spiky word. I mean, it did re-inject a bit of vigor, I think, into the story in terms of, you know, this did feel like it was flagging, I think, at this point, the RTE story, even after all the discussions we've had in recent weeks about exit payments, about confidentiality clauses, about who signed off on them, who had knowledge of them, that whole back and forth and that circular talk around Catherine Martin, Shuni Raleigh, Kevin Backhurst and all that sort of stuff. It did re-liven things up, and so too did the PAC report and their 21 recommendations for restoring trust in RTE. But same time, we described it there as a circular conversation. It is quite a circular conversation, mm-hmm. and it isn't going anywhere particularly fast, although I do feel like public interest in it is going to drop out again as a result of other things happening in the world. Mm. But it doesn't necessarily, from a public interest standpoint, there is reason to do this. And actually, it was only, you know, put further in the spotlight last week when there was that conversation about one of the most senior executives in the HSE leaving. Mm. And again, it was about people who are leaving jobs in either semi-state or state agencies or bodies walking away with big, big exit payments. So that is going to be a big issue for the government to handle. Now, I saw there was a report in the Irish Times there about pay packages to CEOs of state agencies and bodies again. Mm-hmm. So this is, it is a thorny issue for the government to have repeatedly in the news headlines. And I don't think there is going to be any escaping it for the government for some time to come. But they'll probably be thankful if the public is ebbing a little bit in terms of their interest in the story.
Well, it was interesting. I was speaking to Simon Harris about it on Sunday. He did a piece with us outside government buildings, and he said we need to move on from revelations onto recommendations. And he was like, there has to be a point where you turn the corner.
Very Simon Harris thing to say.
Yeah, like it's very, you know, it's a buzz term. But I suppose like there is a point there, isn't there? You know, like at what point, you know, do you decide, right, we can't keep talking about the problem. There has to be a conversation about solutions. And, you know, even to be fair, and we all have colleagues and friends in RTÉ, like it must be so demoralising to be constantly dealing with this, and even having to cover your own organisation as a top story every day when you work in a newsroom, like it just frankly becomes really frustrating.
Yeah. Like I have huge sympathy for my RTÉ counterparts in Leinster House who have to do that so regularly, and it's such a tricky thing to try and feel like you're doing a robust report about yourself and how difficult that is. But I think one thing which is worth, even though it's kind of repeating what we'd said last week to a point, the reason why it keeps coming up and the reason why it's there now is because Catherine Martin did things which do not tally with her stated goal at all. And that's why this is now kind of a live thing. Because, well, so she said that although she was really upset that Shuni Ralig, the RTÉ chair, apparently could not be relied upon to tell her correct things when she asked, you know, so did you know about these exit payments? Did you sign off on them? Whatever. And Shuni Ralig says no twice. And then it turns out, actually, no, yes, she did. She chaired the meeting and she forgot about it. Catherine Martin said, right, even though I didn't say that was intentional, I fully get that it might have just been a slip of the mind or that you'd forgotten that you presided over this meeting. I get that. But I just need to put on record that it's not really good enough that a chair of a state body would not be giving me the correct information when I ask for it. Like that's fair. But Catherine Martin says, I want this to be a thing we can smooth over. And she was talking about sending Shuni Ralig like a written scolding. And Shuni Ralig, as we now know today, because the Oireachtas Media Committee has been sent some of the correspondence, says three times, if you send me a written scolding, I'm going to consider that to be a withdrawal of confidence and I have to go.
And Shuni Ralig said that in her own statement the other day. That which she said to her multiple times, do not send me this letter.
But there is no attempt on Catherine Martin's part to pick up the phone and even have like a 3-minute precursor conversation. Like, okay, fine. You want to have a formal meeting. Schedule the formal meeting for the Friday. Speak to her for 3 minutes on the phone and just say, listen, I don't think this is worth resigning over. I'm not withdrawing confidence. I just need to put in writing that I have higher expectations than this. That's fine.
Can I just pause there for a second? And I want to ask both of you about this, because when I read Shuni Ralig's statement the other day, the one thing that struck me was I could not believe that there wasn't more of a direct line between minister and chair like that. Like, I mean, how do these two women not communicate? Now, I understand there's probably a process and you have to go through officials, and I'm sure there's an element to that, and maybe you can explain that to us, Gavin. But I was quite taken aback that given the seriousness of this crisis, given the ongoing nature of it, given the need for things to be absolutely clear, that there were so many, you know, officials in the department that were passing the message from Shun to Catherine, effectively, that there was such, I could not get over that there was such a spate of middlemen, basically, you know, sort of passing on the message. And we all know, you know, that game where, you whisper into someone's ear and the story changes as it goes around the table. Yeah. You know, like that is essentially what, you know.
I gave you the wrong information, purple monkey dishwasher. Like that's basically what it came down to.
How were they allowed? Like, I don't even understand how in a crisis within, you know, the Department of Communications, the communications was so poor.
Someone senior in government was making the point this week that maybe RTÉ is the one instance where you have to kind of build in that firewall. So in other state agencies, it probably would be more routine for the chair to speak directly to the minister or to the minister's private secretary. Yeah. And you wouldn't be going through secretary general or the senior officials. But they reckon that RTÉ might be the one example where you need to keep a bit of distance because it's the government. And if you're talking to a broadcaster whose primary job is holding the government to account, then it's not really brilliant if you have a hotline where the chair is being followed by the minister. So they were trying to suggest that there was good reason for that. But I still think in the circumstances, Shuni Ralig realises on Thursday morning that she's misled the minister. I think you ring the minister and you sound that out
surely
on the phone.
Surely you have a mobile number or you can send a WhatsApp. Like surely there's, you know, would you not think, Richard?
Look, this is all a bit, again, this is again a bit circular, but
I think it's a bit splitting hairs.
Let me just make the point, because the point you raised there about all middlemen and all that sort of stuff. Well, this is a criticism of Catherine Martin that has existed from the very first day of this controversy, is that she is hands-off, hands-off being the phrase used by Shuni Rahilly. She's not the only person to say that. In fact, multiple members of both the Media Committee and the Public Accounts Committee would say that Catherine Martin has been hands-off, hasn't been on top of the RTE situation. There's been multiple times over multiple months where she hasn't been available to the media, where she hasn't done interviews. Her big defence about going on prime time that time was that, well, I've only done, you know, this is actually, it was only going to be the third time she was on prime time.
She hadn't been on prime time for 2 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's not great. And it does stick a target on the back of Catherine Martin that even now members of the coalition parties are saying, well, I did feel that Catherine Martin had had a hands-off approach, as Alan Dillon said. Timmy Dooley of Fianna Fáil also saying, couldn't find anything to disagree with in Shuni Rahilly's statement, saying that this is kind of our opinion of it too. And I do think that this is something which is just not great for Catherine Martin in her own reputation as, you know, the deputy leader of a coalition partner, that she has a department and a crisis going on in her department for 8-9 months now. And she went to the media committee last week and she was talking about, you know, that my channel of communication on RTE is through the chair of the board and we had monthly meetings and all that sort of stuff. Shuni Rahilly then comes out with a statement saying, no, that's true. I didn't have monthly meetings. It was all really done through senior officials in the department.
Yeah.
There's a question of credibility. There's a question of capability and there's a question of integrity there as well, which has all been thrown into question. And all of this should have been handled a lot better by Catherine Martin if she was on top of this issue, if she demonstrated publicly in media appearances and in statements and just general engagement. Because everybody thought she did a pretty decent job at the at the media committee last week.
Yeah.
She did a pretty decent job. She saved her skin. Nobody in government really at a senior level was like, oh, it's trouble for her now. But the fact of the matter is that there is a lot of criticism around from people who would otherwise support Catherine Martin and would have her back all the way through, that she hasn't done a good enough job on this matter.
So what does Catherine Martin's boss have to say about this? You know, as you mentioned, the senior management in government. If you make a mistake like this in your job in the private sector or if there's a incident like this, you know, you get called in and you get told, you know, this is not really great. And how is it being handled by her bosses, essentially?
I'm trying to figure out how you summarise what her bosses slash boss thinks of all of this. I spoke to the Taoiseach, actually. He was here when he was on the 6 o'clock show last Friday night. I spoke to him afterwards and got an RTE clip out of him. And he basically made the argument that if Catherine Martin had gone prime time and made no mention of this ongoing brewing row, and then it turns out on Friday morning that they'd have to call her in and have another big set too, where they'd established the previous stuff wasn't true, that she'd have been rightly hauled over the coals for a lack of transparency. And I think there's probably some truth to that. The issue that the rest of her cabinet colleagues have now is that if you consider Catherine Martin's job to have been to basically resolve the RTE crisis, you're supposed to be the fire blanket that stops the sparks from spreading elsewhere. Mm. Actually, now she's become more of an agent for the fire to spread to government, where now government is catching the flames from this RTE fire and Catherine Martin did nothing to try and repel that or keep political distance. And that's kind of why it's important. Incidentally, by the way, Catherine Martin is not a texter or a WhatsApper, and I kind of do firmly think that a lot of her own government colleagues on the media committee, who in other circumstances would defend a minister in their own coalition, are less minded to do so because it gives off that general feeling of being aloof, that when they want to go to her and raise something, that she's not as readily accessible in the way that other ministers are because she's a talker, not a texter.
So, Gavin, you will not be here next week. You are literally flying next Wednesday with the Taoiseach to Washington. Leo Varadkar is going to go ahead with this trip to America, despite the fact that people have asked him not to, particularly those who are opposed to the war in Gaza. The point, I suppose, that Taoiseach has made is that he's going to use this opportunity to speak to Joe Biden about a ceasefire as we speak and as we record on Wednesday afternoon, Richard. We've been discussing the fact that ceasefire at the moment is not looking likely.
Looks further away than it has done in a couple of days, all right?
Yeah, but again, this situation is a live and evolving situation, so I'm conscious that it may change by the time you've pressed play on this podcast. But do you think Leo Varadkar has that level of influence on Joe Biden?
Probably not, but if Leo Varadkar didn't take up the meeting, then no one else would be taking up a meeting and no one else might be making that point either. That is the argument that the government has. Mm-hmm. Others are free to disagree. Micheál Martin, in fact, made the point quite well on Wednesday morning that the rest of the world does not hang on what Ireland does. So if Ireland decided to take a grand gesture and send no ministers anywhere, and, you know, ditch its usual plan of travel for St. Patrick's Day in some sort of grand Palestinian solidarity gesture, it would not create the sort of global headlines that some people imagine it might. It wouldn't be this beacon to the world that some people might
disagree
like
on that point, I would say, anyway.
You think the world would stop and go...
I think it would be headlines. If you actually see what's actually taken hold in this story in terms of international solidarity and things which have been done, things like Ireland and Spain writing the letter to Ursula von der Leyen got huge headlines around the world. Boycotts of big global brands got huge headlines around the world. Things like this matter now. If Ireland pulls all of its ministers out of trips from around the world, including the Shamrock ceremony, which is something that people would be able to see and can tangibly pull up file footage of happening before. If Ireland did do that, it would create headlines. I think it's disingenuous of Micheál Martin, particularly from a country like Ireland. So if you go back even to the 1980s, right, and the Dunstores protests around apartheid, the same argument that Micheál Martin makes there could apply there. It's like, well, they aren't going to stop apartheid because we're not handling oranges from South Africa. But yeah, no, it's about... how the world sees it, and the world sees a protest, and it's like, well, maybe other countries should try that as well. So I'm not saying that they should go ahead or they shouldn't go ahead with any of this, but I just find that argument of, well, somebody else would take our place, which is complete nonsense. Who's going to turn up on St. Patrick's Day apart from Nigeria or Montserrat, the other countries
that have St. Patrick as their patron?
I have no problem with the government making the case that we should do this because it's what we've always done, and we think that we can have a sway over things and we can make our influence, and it would be good for the country to do this. Mm. Just make that argument. Don't make the argument that it wouldn't have any impact whatsoever, because it's BS.
But also then, is that kind of to suggest that, like, you know, if you think that not going would make no impact, then do you think that going makes much of an impact? Do you know what I mean?
The argument is probably that not going may not create the headlines people think, but going at least is FaceTime with all of the various ministers of all the various governments all around the world. And that is an opportunity to make your case. And, you know, we've made the point in this podcast before, Ireland views diplomacy as a contact sport, and that you achieve goals by going to talk to people who not otherwise might not think your way. You only have to look this week at the release of Yasser al-Jabouri, the Irish citizen in Iraq. Yeah. That was the Taoiseach calling up the Iraqi foreign minister and basically pulling strings and having charges dropped, according to his own words. Mm-hmm. There was one aspect, though, of this year's programme, which I don't think has kind of caught people's attention yet. So the White House confirmed on Tuesday night exactly what the layout of the programme is going to be. Ordinarily, the Taoiseach is in the White House twice on the same day. Mm-hmm. So having had a breakfast with the Vice President, which was an initiative started by Joe Biden himself, you then go to the White House, you have a bilateral Oval Office meeting with the President, you go up to Capitol Hill for a lunch thrown by the Speaker. Later in the day, then you're back for the reception where the Bowl of Shamrock is presented. People might see the Bowl of Shamrock as being a fairly facetious pat on the head, aren't she's great, very soft ball politics kind of event. And yeah, largely it is. I mean, it's an opportunity to speak in front of an audience, in front of the President, so it has its opportunities, but the real politicking gets done in the bilateral meeting. Mm. This year, those two things are not happening on the same day.
Why is that?
It would appear that Joe Biden, being an Irish Catholic president in his own mind, is not having all of the events on Friday the 15th, as most people expected him to do. He is abandoning his usual practice of going home to Delaware for the weekend, staying in Washington and having a mass in the White House on the Sunday, followed by the Shamrock reception itself.
On actual St. Patrick's Day.
On actual St. Patrick's Day. No, ordinarily it's on the closest weekday. So if St. Patrick's Day falls on a weekend, they would have the events on the Friday and then go about their way.
Is this because he's an Irish-American president and it's possibly his last Paddy's Day in the White House?
And he's got an election campaign coming up and he's in election mode, and maybe he thinks there's an advantage.
Does he think he'll endear himself to the Irish-American voter?
It might well be the case.
He might need them, I'd say.
But a point that's salient is, if Leo Varadkar is claiming that going over there is not you handing a gift to Genocide Joe, but rather you making a point that you want to stand up for the Palestinian people and their welfare and their interests, I think it might be harder to make that point if the actual meeting in the Oval Office has happened 2 days before you're presenting the Bowl of Shamrock. If you've already done the hard politicking behind closed doors, is the second visit not actually just a pat on the back and a tug of the tie and saying, "Dehody blardy, aren't you great?" Like, what is the actual politicking that gets done second time around? I think when we come closer to the time, Leo Varadkar might be under a lot of pressure about going ahead with that second part. I think he will anyway, but a lot of people will be aggrieved that he's going back a second time, having already made the point 2 days previous.
What do you think, Richard? Is that going to be a bit of a difficult one for him?
Possibly is. Just on whether or not, if the government's position then is, well, we're going to have that conversation with them anyway, whether that's 2 days before the Shamrock Bowl ceremony or on the day of the Shamrock Bowl ceremony itself. The US government under Joe Biden has consistently, I think it's probably fair to say, it's bungled a lot of the handling of Gaza and Israel. The fact that Kamala Harris, the vice president, came out only a matter of days ago and said we're now calling for a full ceasefire, which is something if you go back maybe 2 months, 3 months, and actually even repeatedly, if you go through like, you know, the UN General Assembly and Security Council where they vetoed resolutions on ceasefires, they can't continue a consistent position. Like the Biden administration can, for all at once, leak stories about how Joe Biden has called Benjamin Netanyahu an asshole in private and all that sort of stuff. It doesn't change the position. Like,
private chat is not foreign policy.
Exactly, yeah. It doesn't, if you aren't changing your actual policy on it, it doesn't make a difference. But they are finding it increasingly hard to stand over the position which they've dug themselves into on Gaza. So I am interested from the government's perspective, if the case they're making to the case here and to the people here in Ireland is that they're going to raise this issue, I'd love to see the extent to which they do intend on raising it. Mm. I'd love that to be a question that's asked over the next couple of days around that as they prepare to go. How much of an issue are they willing to make it? If are they going to like say, no, hold on, we're not moving on to talk about FDI and other jobs in Ireland. We really want to stress that we need a ceasefire and you guys have the ultimate keys to the car in terms of pushing Israel to a ceasefire. How much of an issue are they willing to make it? I think that's the question really, that if you're going to do what the government is intending to do, they really need to state out how far they are willing to push it.
So they basically need to go with like one issue in mind, Gavin. But like, will they do that? Because, you know, they talk so much about the fact that this is this rare opportunity and it comes every year. Like, does Leo Varadkar have a shopping list of things he wants from an Irish perspective? And is Gaza going to be a sort of an addition to that? Or will he actually decide, right, we're throwing out the list, we're staying on one topic and we're going in?
That push alert is because I took my phone off airplane mode to read the White House release on all of this because I wanted to find...
I love your push alert.
That's the Sky News thing.
Oh, yeah.
But I want to put it up because the White House is openly advertising that they will discuss many different things. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult then for Leo Varadkar to say, oh, screw the FDI, screw the return of power sharing and American support for Northern Ireland peace process. I want to talk about the Middle East. It's like, it's not going to happen. They will discuss the country's shared commitment to continuing support to Ukraine in the face of Russia's brutal aggression, as well as their coordination on a range of other global issues, including the Middle East, reaffirm their steadfast support for the Belfast Good Friday Agreement, welcome the restoration of the Northern Ireland institutions. They will reaffirm the close and enduring partnership between the countries and the extraordinary bonds between their people. Like, America's expecting to discuss multiple things. Mm. So Leo Varadkar can't go over there and just say, nah, Middle East, Middle East only.
Some of them are on the list every year, like, aren't they? Not in a bad way.
What, but like, I don't see how the policy between the bilateral policies on all of these issues is going to change in this one meeting, right? So there's no point in this.
Oh, this is really a busy schedule. We need to talk about
job opportunities in the north and all that. All these things aren't going to change. The direction, particularly on the north, is the same direction it's been for years and years and years. But the issue is the time is of the essence here. Mm. And we can't be fannying about talking about what Leo Varadkar is going to be talking about all the way through on, you know, after on Paddy's Day or not. Mm. 17 children have died of malnutrition in Gaza at hospitals across the Gaza Strip at this point in time. This is a huge man-made food crisis. And the lack of real urgency in not just in Ireland or in the US or in terms of the world and the UN, it really is in stark contrast to what's been happening there.
Absolutely. Just before we leave the United States and US politics, Nikki Haley has pulled out of the race. No real surprise there, Richard. You're going to be our kind of US correspondent as this year progresses on. So tell us your thoughts, your takes.
Well, the inevitable is no longer delayed. She was hanging in there as long as possible, probably in the hopes that Donald Trump gets convicted. It's not going to change things. He's going to be on the ballot. Joe Biden's going to be on the ballot. And it's Biden versus Trump too. So,
but do you think that Kamala Harris might have been sent out to make that point about ceasefire last week precisely because Joe Biden and his stance on Gaza is actually a bit of a fly in the ointment when it comes to the primaries?
I think it's a major problem, and not even just in the primaries. We've talked about it before, that young voters, young progressive voters, of which the sort the Biden campaign needs to win the election, they need a big turnout from young voters. Young voters are very turned off Joe Biden. Every poll is pointing that way at this point in time. It doesn't matter how left-wing they are, they're not...
Yeah, but they're not turned on to Donald Trump.
But you still...
then they don't turn up at all.
Yeah, exactly, that's the point.
Stay at home, it's about Joe Biden doesn't win.
Yeah. You can't win without your core support coming out for you. And the problem is that at the moment, Joe Biden hasn't done enough for his core support to come out. And that's a big, big problem.
I think he has a big problem coming up soon now, because now that Donald Trump basically has a free run of the Republican primary, there's no other candidates left. And Joe Biden will still, okay, granted, yeah, he's basically the only candidate left, but we will see this continuing trend as emerged in American Samoa on Super Tuesday night, where the winner was a right-wing candidate who opposes the stance on the Middle East. And that becomes the news. So Donald Trump will now have free reign for the next 8 months to get himself completely ready for the first Tuesday in November. And Joe Biden will still be looking at internal party politicking about what they're doing in the Middle East. And that's going to be a problem for him going forward.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, I know that there are a lot of people who are watching tonight and who are listening who are in probably the same boat as a lot of people got in touch with us about the fact that they feel there's a referendums, plural, I should say, happening on Friday. They've probably gotten a polling card through the front door and they're still kind of going to themselves, what am I actually being asked? And we've had loads of questions in from people, and thank you so much. There was a lot of them that were repeat questions, admittedly. So we've kind of picked...
But that's good.
It's good. It's good. So we've picked the top five frequently asked questions and we're going to delve into those ones.
One thing we should say, by the way, and we're very grateful for all the questions, the nature of a slot like this is that we actually can't discuss the merits and demerits. So we're just going to touch in a very, very calm, informational sense what exactly is coming up.
More the gist of it.
Point of order before we move on is actually... I'm actually really glad that referendums has overtaken referenda as the way of describing referendums.
Yeah, it's a bit old,
there we go.
Isn't it? Fair play. Okay, let's start by taking a look at the ballot paper for the first one, right? Yeah. So this is what you're going to see when you go into the ballot box on Friday. Okay, so we're going to start. This is the family amendment. Gavin, what is the family amendment? This is the paper you're going to be looking at.
Yeah, you'll see the kind of the shaded box in the middle of the ballot paper there. It says the 39th Amendment to the Constitution, the family bill. That's the only thing that's different between the two ballot papers other than their colour. So that's important.
Which
so
the
you know.
Is a bit confusing.
It's the design of ballot papers and referendums is a long-standing bugbear of a lot of people, and it's something that every government says they might look at and no one ever gets around to doing because, let's face it, it's not a priority.
Okay.
But the question, what is the family amendment?
Yes.
At present, the Constitution recognises that the family is basically the essential ingredient. You might think of it as the basic building block of society. But the Constitution defines the family only as being something founded on the institution of marriage. Marriage is described elsewhere in the Constitution as the institution upon which the family is founded. And the courts have interpreted that across the years, that families founded through any other means do not meet this constitutional definition of what a family is. The amendment being put to the people on Friday on that white ballot paper is that the definition of family be widened so that while there would still be recognition of marriage and marriage would still have a special status, that families could also be recognised as being founded on what are called other durable relationships.
And that's the durable relationship thing is the one thing that people have split hairs over.
It is a phrase which is, in short, not defined within the amendment itself and a matter of some discussion in the world.
Okay.
In terms then of the second question or the other question in this, the care amendment, what one's that? That one has generated a lot of talk, I suppose. It's probably when probably the most heated, I'd say, discussion in terms of which way the referendums are going to go or how people are deciding how to vote. What is actually the care amendment about?
That's the green ballot papers. That's the other one that people will be handed when they go in on Friday. At present, the Constitution recognises that woman, I hope I'm getting the words exactly right here, women through their work in the home offer to society a common good which could not be otherwise achieved in the state. And that therefore the state will endeavour that mothers will not have to neglect their duties in the home by taking paid work elsewhere outside of the home. The proposal is to remove those two sentences in their entirety and insert a brand new article, Article 42B, called Care, which would effectively recognise that the provision of care among family members by reason of the bonds that exist among them, and that the state would strive to support the provision of care among family members.
And people hate the word strive.
People have disagreements about the word strive. The Referendum Commission has said that strive means try very hard, whereas endeavour in the existing wording means try. People can make up their own minds as to whether they think that's appropriate.
But the point being actually that, you know, these are the, this is the basis for it. So you vote on the basis of, you know, the wording that is being offered. So people need to kind of be aware
and,
of that.
And to be vote. To be very clear about it, a yes in both votes or in either ballot paper is approving the change. Sometimes people think, you know, we had this question back when marriage equality, you know, are you in favour of gay marriage? Yes or no. Are you in favour of abortion? Yes, no. The toll is not, are you in favour of, are you in favour of this change? Do you want to make the change? You vote yes. Mm-hmm. If you oppose the change and would rather things stay as they are, you vote no. Mm. So yes is always the vote to adopt the new thing. No is leave it as it is.
But so people are wondering, why was it called now? Why now? Why this timing?
Why now? Well, the government specifically chose this Friday because it's International Women's Day, and they thought that was an appropriate date in which you would have the question put to the people about what the Constitution says about women. Why it's happening at all is because the government before last organised a citizens' assembly about all of this language and about the recognition of care in the Constitution, about how families are defined. The citizens' assembly put forward reports, then they were sent to Oireachtas committees, and the process has kind of been through every level of talking shop in society that it can be through. And we're just now at the point where there's nothing else to be done with the questions except to put them to the people. But where they came from, or where this initiative came from, is the government before last organised a citizens' assembly which recommended that some of these changes be made.
People will have seen the posters up in most towns, villages, cities at this point in time. But where do the different parties and groupings then stand? Because people will see, generally speaking, the big parties' posters. But where does everybody stand?
Well, actually, quite a few of the questions that we got in, people were suggesting that actually they hadn't seen very many posters at all.
I was about to say to you, I don't think I've seen
I think they're quite visible around Dublin city centre. But I think
I haven't seen them at all in Dublin.
Loads around Dublin city centre.
There's a few in the city centre, but there's traditionally always an awful lot of posters on the likes of Merrion Street and Kildare Street.
Exactly.
Because that's where the politicians all work.
They don't want to go far.
But they don't go terribly far. And it is true to say that a lot of political parties have not put great number of resources into these campaigns, although that's probably because there are local and European elections coming up in 3 months, maybe a general before the end of the year. So they are holding forth on a lot of their resources for those. Where they stand, the three government parties, as you might anticipate, are all in favour of a yes vote on both ballots. So that's referred to as yes, yes. The three largest opposition parties are also in favour of yes, yes. So that's Sinn Féin, Labour and the Social Democrats. Solidarity were previously yes, yes, but they in the last couple of days have now changed their minds and they are yes, no. In other words, yes on the family amendment, but no on the care amendment. AIN2, the party founded by Pádraig Tabean, is no, no. As is Independent Ireland. That's the new political party founded by some of the rural independent TDs, Michael Collins, Richard O'Donoghue, Michael Fitzmaurice more recently. They're in favour of no, no. And there is a broad coalition of civil society groups, as you might expect, are on both sides of the fence.
Okay. And so what are the latest polls telling us about it?
The most recent polls were at the weekend. And basically what they showed is that there is a growing number of people that are undecided, which is probably
really echoes what we've heard from listeners of the podcast.
It's the most telling thing about the nature of the campaigns thus far, that because there hasn't been great political capital spent on them, they've been relatively lackluster. They haven't really dominated the news agenda very much, which is the way in which they often sort of cut through and people begin to appreciate what's going on. The last opinion polls showed that there was still, if you were to factor out the undecideds, that there would still be a relatively healthy lead for the yes side and both. But of course, as you come up to polling day, the last few days are often the days in which people traditionally more engage with the issues. They start discussing with their friends and family how they feel. And effectively, all sides feel there was an awful lot to play for. So while the polls said at the weekend that the yes side was in a fairly healthy lead, that does not at all say that the outcome was at all preordained. That was very much all to play for.
Yeah. What is a good turnout for a referendum in general? What's the best turnout you can recall? I'm putting you on the spot here now.
I certainly remember that at the time, there were more ballot papers cast on the marriage referendum in 2015 than had ever been cast for anything ever. I can't remember whether that was overtaken then by the referendum in 2018 on abortion, on repealing the 8th. But either way, they were both, if memory serves, in the region of the high 60s percentage-wise. Mm. And I mean, a lot of people think that the register of electors is in pretty rag order, and there's a lot of people that are their duplicates or people who are deceased still listed as electors. So a high percentage in many cases is actually even higher than it represents. The lowest ever is in the region of 25% back in 1979 on adoption and on extending the university franchise for the Shannon. And it's been underwhelming, and people will be wondering whether this would be very much higher than that.
You have an explainer, which is up on our social media pages at this point in time, Gav. So if people have more questions, they can probably check that out. And then you'll be on the weekend on our news bulletins.
Yeah.
Run the rule over it as it happens.
Saturday. Working Saturday and Sunday, because that's how we roll sometimes. So if you are not watching the Six Nations, or if you think that democracy is more important than sport, you can watch our bulletins on Friday and Saturday evening and find out everything there is to know.
So the Oscars are taking place in Hollywood this Sunday. And once again, Ireland is just flying it. 12 nominations, including 11 for Element Pictures in Dublin for Poor Things. And Cillian Murphy, Richard, and he is on the campaign trail.
Cillian Murphy is pulling out all the stops. We can talk about why he's doing that and why it matters to him so much in a bit. But it is worth noting the odds of, do you remember at the start of the campaign when he was first nominated? Yeah. Everybody expected that. He was very much the front runner early on. Then it seemed like Paul Giamatti, that it was a two horse race for Holdovers versus Oppenheimer, and Cillian versus Paul Giamatti, a fantastic character actor.
Mm-hmm. But then Cillian's been winning all the other awards in award seasons.
It looks as much a lock to Hollywood observers as any of these things can ever be, which is incredible. But they're leaving nothing to chance, right? So Cillian Murphy has appeared on every talk show, chat show. He did 60 Minutes. He brought Scott Pelley of 60 Minutes over to Ireland for a big profile interview where, you know, Scott Pelley interviewed people who knew and acted with Cillian before, and he brought him to a beach and a pub and all that sort of stuff. He's done magazine covers. He's done absolutely everything.
So he's turned the Oscars into his WrestleMania. He wants to finish the story.
This is it. But like, this is
the man who, by the way, doesn't court attention and isn't really a big
absolutely.
Fan of
yeah,
media.
Yeah. But yeah. This is why it's noteworthy. And I think fair play to him, because he's doing a great job on the circuit as somebody who himself says that he's not naturally predisposed for it. Yeah, exactly. So he's done all the mad photo shoots. I think there was one for Esquire, which people were drawing comparisons that he looked quite like Barry Keoghan in Saltburn for doing that, that photo shoot. He's done the actor on actor where actors are interviewing actors, that thing which everybody actually really doesn't like because it's incredibly dull. But he's done this because he wants to make this happen, right? Mm-hmm. And for, like, we in Ireland are very familiar with the works of Cillian Murphy. We know him all down through the years, all of everything from Disco Pigs all the way through to Wind That Shakes the Barley,
Breakfast and Pluto,
Peaky Blinders, Breakfast of Pluto, all these things.
Yeah.
In the States, in terms of motion pictures and films, big screen films, he has not traditionally been a leading actor of the top tier in terms of demand and the amount of money that they can demand for appearances. He's a latecomer to that space.
Like, he's a newcomer essentially to those.
Exactly. He's a phenomenal actor. He's been like a secondary or a supporting actor in a lot of big films over the years. But this was a real shot by Christopher Nolan to put his guy who he's worked with for so long in so many different films into the A spot, because he knew he could carry out the role, and he's done that incredibly well. But the payday that could await him if he wins this Oscar in terms of being the guy in casting for when people are making the next, you know, big films is huge. It will be life-changing. The career of Cillian Murphy will be very different post-Oscars as it was pre-Oscars.
And is that then obviously there is the function of winning an Oscar itself, and that is an attainment of most people's life's work in its own right. But is that, you think, then what the ultimate motive is, that by playing this publicity game, like electioneering as it is?
We spoke to
Sheridan last year, and he really pointed out how much of an electioneering game it
you're
is.
You're on the hustings, like, you know what I mean?
Exactly. And if it's not his natural forte, or that he's out of his comfort zone, he's doing that because he knows it's an investment in pushing himself into the next strata.
Well, it's taking his career up a gear. It's the next level
of
his career, you know.
And he can get things made which he otherwise may not have done. Mm-hmm. People will talk about small things like these, which is that film he's co-producing with Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, based on the Claire Keegan novella, which is coming out. It's about mother and baby home. It's going to be a phenomenal talking point of a film. But this gives him much more pull in Hollywood than he has had traditionally. And it's very clear to see he really wants to win this, right? Mm. If he's doing this because he wants to win this. And I think it was Carey Mulligan said a few years ago, anyone in Hollywood who says they don't really care about the awards is completely lying. Just look at Bradley Cooper at the SAG Awards there last week when his face completely dropped as Cillian Murphy's name was read out. Should be said, Bradley Cooper, if you went back 2 years ago before any of these films actually came out, his portrayal of Leonard Bernstein in Maestro was that this is he's this is a cakewalk.
Yeah.
He's going to win this. And he's done all the campaigning as well. It's been pretty weird for Bradley Cooper.
He's been pictured sitting in a river.
Yeah. No, he's been sitting in a river in his boxers as part of a New York Times thing. What actors do in their spare time? He was with Leonard Bernstein's children saying how much he misses their dad and broke down crying in front of them very, very awkwardly. What? It's just, yeah.
So he's grieving the loss of their father more than his children are.
Yeah. It was pilloried and panned by the online film community. The amount of campaigning, it's a very difficult line. You can see from what Bradley Cooper has done to much ridicule. It's a delicate line. It's a difficult tightrope to walk. But Killian's done a great job of it.
Yeah, and I think in fairness to him, maybe it lands better because it's authentic. Like, I mean, I know the campaigning has to be a certain amount of showbiz or whatever, but there's probably a level of authenticity there because he doesn't do press all the time. You know what I mean? So there's an element of like the story hasn't been told, that he hasn't been heard, he hasn't been overexposed. And actually, I always think it's really interesting when you see famous people like that who don't do a lot of press. You want to read the articles, you want to watch the pieces on them because you feel like there's new information and there's things to be learned about.
It almost seems like he's played it perfectly from that sense, because if he is doing the electioneering, the politicking that needs to be done, cast that against that memeable moment from about a month ago where I forget which one of the red carpets he was walking, but he kind of just like almost like floated along like he was on a skateboard, one of those hoverboard things, like a ghost, basically kind of looking around, making generalized eye contact with everyone holding a microphone, but just kind of sailing past them, not speaking, because he's not a guy who's comfortable doing that sort of thing.
A point actually on the red carpet and the questions which are thrown at people and posing for the photographs. It was at the SAG Awards, again, Screen Actors Guild Awards, just last weekend. People might have seen the clip where he just looks dead behind the eyes as people keep on shouting Cillian at him.
Oh, God.
And it's like, he's been around long enough. He's the front runner for best actor at the Oscars. The first time an Irish-born person will potentially ever win this award. He's not some newcomer or some, unknown. Get his name right.
Yeah,
please.
I know. It's a bit cringe, isn't it? Like, it's just a bit cringe.
There is a bit, particularly because these people are people who work in the industry, the photographers and all that. They're there to take
but
photographs.
It's exactly what you say, though, right? At the moment, it's like, yeah, he's a nominee or whatever. So, like, learning his name doesn't seem as important to them. But watch the minute he wins it, they'll all be,
No one's going to be in the after room shouting Cillian up at the stage.
Could well happen. I wouldn't be surprised.
Really?
But there's a point, actually, just in terms of this seems like a lock. This seems like a lock that Cillian Murphy is going to win best picture.
You were saying that there's one thing which is not a lock.
Yes. So a lot of Hollywood, the way that you might have read some of these, like Variety and other movie publications, they do these anonymous Oscar ballot or an anonymous Oscar voter, how they vote on their Oscar ballot, who they put for best picture, best actor, best actress, blah, 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 all the way down. And there has been a move in recent days and weeks as more and more mainstream Hollywood people watch all of the best picture nominees. That zone of interest, which is the story, it's based around Auschwitz in the Second World War, obviously, that has gained a lot of momentum. And that was such an outsider of a film.
But now people all thought Oppenheimer.
Exactly, yeah. And there was, I can't remember what else was sort of seen as a secondary to Oppenheimer for it, but that zone of interest is now seen as the second favourite in it. And some people think that it might actually pip Oppenheimer in the end. But it just shows that a lot of these things and a lot of the conversations we have about who's going to win what, a lot of it is by people, and people who actually have their hands on the lever and make the decisions don't actually see the films until the last possible moment, which is, it's not a great endorsement.
I remember that point been made before, actually, that a lot of the Oscar nominees, or nominators rather, don't have the opportunity to watch a lot of them. So there's a kind of a herd or a groupthink anyway, that if everyone says, oh, Cillian Murphy's great in that, or Emma Stone is great in Poor Things.
That is not right, though.
And then everyone kind of goes, it sounds like she's great, and it kind of becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy. But that's happened before, isn't it? Like the year that everyone thought La La Land would win, and they did, except actually they didn't because it was Moonlight, or the year when Parasite won and nobody saw that would be Best Picture. Like, it has a habit of being a curveball. So stay open-minded to it.
Well, on behalf of the group chat, I would personally like to wish Cillian Murphy the best of luck on Sunday night. And if you listen to the podcast at all, Cillian, we're bloody thrilled for you. So best
we're
of luck.
We're rigorous impartial journalists.
I can't
and
wait.
We have no major standing.
I think he's going to be running. No, he's Irish. He's our own. We want him to win. Can I just play a song for you here for a moment? You'll know this song really, really well. Just take a quick listen to this beautiful voice of Sinead O'Connor. That is Sinead O'Connor singing her iconic Nothing Compares to You. Obviously so beautiful. And every time you hear it, I think it just gives you chills. Sinead O'Connor's estate has asked Donald Trump to stop using the music at political rallies. He has had the audacity to use "Nothing Compares to You, Richard" at a political rally, and a joint statement from Sinead O'Connor's estate and her long-term label said, "Throughout her life, it is well known that Sinead O'Connor lived by a fierce moral code defined by honesty, kindness, fairness and decency towards her fellow human beings." They go on to say, "It was with outrage, therefore, that we learned that Donald Trump has been using her iconic performance of 'Nothing Compares to You' at his political rallies. It is no exaggeration," they say, "that Sinead would have been disgusted, hurt and insulted to have her work misrepresented in this way by someone who she herself referred to as a biblical devil."
I was looking for that quote there, yeah, the biblical devil one. No surprise at all to see the estate of Sinead O'Connor do this. It did jar as somebody who sees a lot of Trump rallies online for as part of the job. To see this song picked and to see an outrage come out of the backside of it, because that does traditionally happen. There's a long list, there's a long Wikipedia page of artists around the world who have demanded that Donald Trump cease and desist from using their music. Johnny Marr of the Smiths, who is of course playing a homecoming show in Athy, County Kildare this year.
Does he think Donald Trump is a charmless man?
Yeah, there you go. But like, there's been a huge whole list of people who are like, "Don't use my music. Don't agree with your politics. Stop using it." Also, it should be said, Donald Trump picks all the music himself personally.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, he does. Really? Yeah, he's a big muso, as they're said, as
loves
they're called.
Loves the tunes.
But it is also worth knowing that previously people like Phil Collins have said, "Stop using In the Air Tonight at my rallies," and he's gone ahead and just picked it up and done it again. So that's something to watch out for. He has not always adhered to these requests.
See, literally, while we've been recording this item, Nikki Haley has formally dropped out anyway, so maybe he'll have fewer events that he needs to play music for in the meantime anyway.
But sorry, if people ask you to stop using their music and you said there, he goes back and uses it again, like, you know, there's nothing stopping him from doing it. It's just,
it's more of a polite acknowledgement
that you stop doing it, is it?
No, I think people feel very strongly about the politics of Donald Trump, and they indicate that they would pursue it in courts. And basically, Donald Trump is hoping that either they forget about it, they don't notice it happening again, or that they're just not willing to spend loads of money going to the courts to do it. So,
right, okay.
Enough other court-related financial mishaps in the recent past anyway, so he could afford not to be picking more fights.
Absolutely. Well, listen, we are nearly out of time. I just want to remind people that we do have an email address now.
We do, yes.
Now, I actually haven't managed to connect the email address to my inbox yet, but you guys are checking it, right?
The group chat at virginmedia.ie is the email address that we all very rigorously and very routinely check.
No, I am going to actually sign up to put in my inbox now this week. But do send us your emails. Like, you know, you can send us voice notes as well. If there's issues you want us to cover, there's things you want to talk about, drop us an email, the group chat at virginmedia.ie. And of course, you can get us across all our social media platforms. Gavin is travelling next week. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be you and me holding down this fort.
Here. What a show we're going to have next week, Zara.
Let's find someone else to come in and join us for a few minutes, will we?
I don't know. I think
want to come on the group chat next week, send us an email.
If you want to pitch for my spot next week, send us an email. Let us know.
They'll be brownies. Anyway, that's all we have time for, guys. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Gavin. Thank you, Richard.
Thanks, Zara.
Thank you, Rory. Thank you, Neil, and all the team, Darren, everyone in the gallery. And we will catch you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.